Hello, everyone, and thanks for tuning in to this edition of the Cigna podcast series. I'm your host, Kathy Vaccaro, and today we're discussing wellness programs and incentive regulations. Here to help us understand this topic is Carrie Stevens, who is the managing counsel in Cigna's legal organization and also oversees Cigna's healthcare reform consulting and communications team. Carrie, thanks for joining us for today's podcast.
Hi, Kathy. Thanks for having me here today.
Our pleasure. So let's dive right in. So wellness programs and incentives have been around for years, but how did the healthcare reform legislation affect wellness programs?
Wellness programs have been around for many years, Kathy, and for a long time, the law was pretty unclear about how they were supposed to work. So we had some guidance under HIPAA, some minimal guidance under the Americans with Disabilities Act, but there wasn't a complete level of clarity for employers, but employers decided to proceed despite this uncertainty and put into place wellness programs because they really do have great return on investment and they're great for an employer's workforce. But what the ACA did a few years ago is it really legitimized the way that these programs were viewed in the eyes of the law. So it gave these programs a boost. It says, they said Congress, the President, they said, we support wellness programs, and we're going to give employers guidelines about what they need to do to comply. So really it was showing public policy around these programs that promote a culture of health and more productive employees, and they're a great way to promote long-term savings. And then, like I said, it gave employers finally some certainty in terms of what they needed to do to comply with the law.
That is really a lot, and it sounds like it's really helpful for employers. But what are some of the legal and compliance considerations when it comes to these wellness programs?
Well, when we talk about wellness programs internally, Kathy, we refer to them as a regulatory alphabet soup because it's just one area where so many different laws are converging in one place. Now, I mentioned the ACA and how that was great and it really promoted wellness programs, but there are a lot of different laws that also come into play. And as what you're going to hear about today is that complying with one doesn't mean complying with all. So it really is this regulatory alphabet soup. So we have the ACA on the one hand, but then we also have a whole set of rules that's regulated by the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. So that's the Americans with Disabilities Act and the Genetic Information Non-Discrimination Act. Those are known as the ADA and GINA. Those both govern wellness programs, and it's really a hot topic right now because the EEOC just issued final regulations under both of those laws in May of 2016. And in there, they gave a roadmap around how wellness programs what they need to do to comply with the ADA and GINA. So we have the ACA, we have the ADA, we have GINA. In addition, we have HIPAA. HIPAA's been around for a while, and that has certain provisions on what needs to happen in wellness programs. ERISA comes into play because many wellness programs are baked into group health plans. And like I said, employers have to think of all these different laws when they're thinking about their wellness program because they have to comply with each one separately.
That was really helpful and really confusing. But before we dig into the alphabet soup, can you give us examples of what the different types of wellness plans are that are impacted by these regulations?
So there are two primary types of wellness programs, Kathy, and they're broken down into either participatory wellness programs or health contingent wellness programs. And why is this important? Employers need to know exactly what type of program they have because their compliance obligations flow from there. So there might be some different things they need to think about in the health contingent space versus the participatory space or just across the board. So when I talk about a participatory program, that's one of those programs where you just have to show up in order to receive the incentive. It's not linked to any particular outcome or any particular, you know, attaining any particular activity goal. It's just showing up. So it might be something like attending a health seminar or completing a health risk assessment. Now, those health contingent programs I mentioned, those are programs that are tied to a specific activity or outcome. So there are those types of programs that are called activity-based, and that's when the employee needs to commit to do something like an exercise program or a coaching program to receive a reward. On the flip side of that, you have your outcome-based programs, which are becoming much more popular, and that's where a reward is tied to a specific health outcome. So, for example, lowering BMI or cholesterol.
Carrie, that was really good. But can you help our listening audience understand the high-level issues and the differences between the healthcare reform or the ACA, the ADA, and GINA wellness regulations?
I can. And so this continues to be a hot topic because, of course, Kathy, as I mentioned, there's all these different laws. They're regulated by different agencies, and the agencies, you know, have different positions on this. So they don't coordinate across the board. And three areas where employers really need to look at where there are nuances between these three laws, the ACA, the ADA, and GINA. The first area is incentives, how those incentives are calculated and capped. The provision of reasonable alternatives. So when do those reasonable alternatives need to be offered in the wellness space for individuals who can't attain the reward? And then finally, each of the laws kind of treat privacy and confidentiality a little bit different. Employers have different obligations there.
That's great, Carrie. Can we take these one at a time just to make sure our audience understands them? And let's discuss incentive limits first.
Right. So incentive limits, this goes back to the type of program that the employer has. So if the employer has one of those health contingent programs that I talked about, so that's the activity-based or the outcome-based, the Affordable Care Act allows incentives up to 30% of the cost of coverage in which the employee is enrolled. And this percentage goes up to 50% if the incentive is tied to tobacco cessation. So the ADA rules differ. So the ADA rules say, okay, you can have an incentive, but that is based on 30% of participation in a health contingent program or a participatory program, and you have to look at it across the wellness program as a whole. And so basically at the end of the day, the ADA caps the incentive at 30%, and that 30% is based on the cost of self-only coverage. So the difference between ADA and ACA is ACA only looks at the health contingent piece, while the ADA looks at both the health contingent and the participatory piece. ACA caps that 30% based on the total cost of coverage in which the employee is enrolled, while ADA caps it as self-only coverage. So there are differences there. And then under GINA, there's another nuance. So GINA sets the rules on how you incentivize an employee when their spouse participates in the wellness program and completes a health risk assessment. So there are special rules under GINA then that say, okay, you can only give the spouse, a 30% incentive, but that's also tied to the cost of self-only coverage. So it can get a little bit confusing, Kathy, and that's why employers need to understand their type of program, and then they need to look at their incentive amounts to make sure it meets all these different thresholds.
They really do need to pay attention, don't they?
Absolutely.
So you also mentioned reasonable alternatives. Can we talk about that for a few minutes?
We can. So reasonable alternatives are very key to both the ACA requirements and the ADA requirements, but the rules do slightly differ. So under the ACA, employers with wellness programs are required to give reasonable alternatives as part of those health contingent programs. They're not required to give them as part of participatory programs. So the ACA says if you have an activity-based incentive program or if you have an outcome-based program, you need to offer reasonable alternatives. For the activity-based program, in order to get a reasonable alternative, a participant must demonstrate medical need in order to receive the reasonable alternative. But for the outcome-based piece, the alternative is not contingent on that medical need. It's just the participant just needs to show that they can't obtain that standard. Now, again, the ADA differs. So the ADA says you need to offer reasonable alternatives across the board no matter what type of program you have. So in these final regs we just got under the ADA, they give us some examples. So they say, for example, if you're going to have a health seminar and you have somebody with a disability who is deaf that's going to attend the seminar, you need to make sure a sign language interpreter is provided at that seminar. And that's the reasonable alternative. Also, there needs to be a reasonable alternative for something like completing a health risk assessment. So maybe instead of the health risk assessment, which if it's a participatory program, the employer would let the employee instead go get a preventative health care screening from their doctor. So bottom line is the reasonable alternative standard is much broader under the ADA.
That was great, Carrie. And last but not least, could we ask you to spend a little bit of time talking about the differences with privacy and confidentiality?
Sure. So privacy and confidentiality is really a concept that originally comes from HIPAA. So as part of wellness programs, employers are getting access to protected health information, and they need to make sure that they safeguard that in accordance with HIPAA. Makes sense. The ACA doesn't specifically address privacy and confidentiality concerns, but this is a very significant component of the ADA rules. And the ADA rules require programs to receive information in the aggregate so that any individual in the wellness program is not identifiable. And what does that mean? The ADA wants to make sure that any individually identifiable information stays out of the hands of people who are making decisions at the company, employment-based decisions, so wouldn't want supervisors or managers or anybody who could influence that employee's employment to get access to that information. So both the ADA and GINA require that employers distribute confidentiality notices that talk to employees about, you know, how your medical information is going to be collected, why is it going to be collected, and who has access to it. And they both specifically prohibit employers from requiring the sale, exchange, transfer, or other disclosure of protected health information as a condition to participating in the program or receiving incentives.
Is there anything else that employers should be aware of?
So a few more things, Kathy, and I wanted to highlight GINA in particular. That's the Genetic Information Non-Discrimination Act, because I've been going back and forth a little bit about the ADA versus the ACA. But GINA is really important, too, and employers need to be mindful of it with their wellness programs. So broadly speaking, GINA regulates and restricts employers from requesting, requiring, or purchasing genetic information from employees unless an exception applies. So there are exceptions for wellness programs because sometimes employers ask about medical history and health risk assessment or even, you know, genetic-related information from their employees as part of a wellness program. So GINA sets up parameters around that and basically say, you know, you can't tie an incentive to the employee specifically for providing genetic information. So if you have a genetic question on your HRA for your employee, you need to make sure that it's clear that that question is voluntary and that somebody's still going to get the incentive even if they don't answer that question. Similarly, an employee can't be penalized for not providing genetic information. And now, in these new rules that we just got, Kathy, in May of 2016, what we know now is that there was an open question about, well, how can employers allow spouses to participate in HRAs? And the reason that was a question is because the definition of genetic information is so broad, it arguably includes family history. So if you're asking for information about a spouse, you're asking about the employee's family history. So what the EEOC did is they set up these rules and set up an exception which regulates how spouses can participate in health risk assessments, you know, when can they provide their health information and get incentivized for doing so without running afoul of GINA. And so there are rules around that. The rules do prohibit genetic information to be collected from spouses or children, but now we know health information from spouses can be collected so long as it's within the GINA rules. So bottom line is any wellness program that has, you know, any questions or screenings where genetic information could be solicited really needs to be viewed through the lens of GINA.
Very helpful information for employers to understand. Thank you for that, Carrie. So lastly, what should employers keep in mind when they're implementing wellness programs and incentives?
Well, I went through a lot of the rules here today, Kathy, and it is really complicated. If nothing else, I hope I've conveyed that. And just wanted to hit home that we know that compliance with one set of rules does not necessarily ensure compliance with all the others. So employers need to understand all these rules. We believe at Cigna that the pros of wellness programs certainly outweigh all the compliance considerations, but employers definitely need to be mindful of these considerations and comply so that they get the benefit of all the wellness programs have to offer. So I would just say for employers to, you know, make sure that they're staying on top of the law, stay educated and get informed about these different rules, and then, you know, every year when they're looking at their wellness programs to assess their programs against the rules and make sure that they comply.
Thank you very much, Carrie, and thanks again for joining us today. We really appreciate it. And thanks to our listening audience for tuning in. As I'm sure you've gathered from our discussion today, the healthcare reform conversation is far from over. For more information on healthcare reform topics, be sure to check out the resources available on our award-winning website, informedonreform.com. Thanks for listening to this edition of the Cigna podcast series.
This podcast reflects Cigna's understanding of the topics discussed as of June 8, 2016. Cigna's produced podcasts are for general information purposes only and should not be construed as legal or tax advice. Cigna makes no warranties concerning the content of this podcast and expressly disclaims all liability relating to anything done or not done in reliance upon the use or contents of this podcast. The material in this podcast may not be reproduced in whole or in part without express written permission from Cigna.